You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show. Here I'm Dave Pratz, Star Worldwide Networks, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Dagnolo, and tonight my guest is author and documentarian Marshall Terrell, a man maybe best known as the world's foremost historian author on Steve McQueen, one of Hollywood's most famous movie stars. This show is brought to you in part by my good friends at Fervor Records and also by the RecordingArtist.com, where I've been cutting a new record with a different band every week for the last couple of years, live online. If you've missed any of the over 80 live recording sessions, don't worry. You can still catch snippets on my reality-style TV show called The Recording Artist, which is available on Amazon Prime and at TheRecordingArtist.com. And if you've got Roku TV, then you can just download the free Roku TV channel called The Recording Artist. To learn more, go to TheRecordingArtist.com. And now, without further ado, let me welcome to the show my guest, Marshall Terrell. Hey, Marshall, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, thanks for coming into the studio here to do this. To call you an author is a little understatement. I mean, you are extremely prolific, over 30 published titles.
That's right.
How many books are not published?
That's a great question. I had one book, believe it or not, that I wrote and somebody stole it.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, he took it and then went to go self-publish it. So that's one that was in the can that never
got properly published. How did it get resolved?
I don't want to say who his name was, but he was a basketball player. And I did a story, worked on it for 4 years.
Wow.
Took it and self-published it. And
it was kind of a biography.
Yeah.
Just think that was something he was going to get? Did he just not understand, or what happened?
Oh, he totally understood what he was doing. And the wow. But you know what? The book didn't do anything, and so it was kind of like, I look back at it as a blessing. Uh-huh. So, but then I've got two more that are in the can. I just finished one. I can't say who it's on, but it's on a serial killer. And then I'm 5 chapters away from finishing a book on a celebrity hairstylist by the name of Jay Sebring, who was killed by the Manson family.
Mm.
And then I've got a book in the can with Greg Laurie, an evangelist. It's called Fame. And it's the exploration of the idea of fame and how young people today, that's all they want to be. They don't want to be a doctor or a lawyer. I think 50% of them want to be famous.
Yeah, yeah. And they don't want to work. In fact, I've talked with teens who say, well, I don't want to work because pretty soon we won't have to. I'm like, what do you mean? Well, it'll all be AI and it'll be automated. So I'm just waiting. I'm like, okay, you see a future. I don't understand how we're going to get there, but you know, I wouldn't wait too long. But it's a different world today than it was when we were growing up. And it's going to be, you know, I can't imagine another 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. And I like the fact that we both have a foot in the old school and a foot in today's new technology.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about you quite a bit and what you've had to endure with the recording industry. Cause I've written about this.
You're a big music fan with a lot of titles in music.
Yeah. But I'm fascinated with the idea that, you know, the music industry from a financial standpoint kind of went to hell in 2000 with Napster. Now we're 23 years down the road. So it's always interesting to hear. It was kind of like an apocalypse is the way I look mm-hmm. at it, and like how people are doing. You seem to have transitioned very well. Some people don't know how to make that transition. So it's always interesting writing about those sorts of things.
It seemed to be the rule was every 20 years in the music business, there'd be something new, like from the cassette tape to the 8-track tape to compact discs, you know, to Napster, digital files, to streaming, seem to be these leaps of that kind of time period. AI is going to completely wreak havoc in the music industry, as already seen just by people having fun with, hey, you know, I had a friend on Facebook actually post, he asked ChatGPT to write a song, a country song, I think he said, about this or about that, with this style lyric, and it wrote this incredibly great lyric. And so then everyone was like, oh, this is horrible. This is the end of the world. And, you know, he's like, first I thought it was cool. And then I got all freaked out. And I said, look, until the law determines that everything ChatGPT creates is a violation of copyright because it's taking it from someplace, it's kind of the wild, wild west. I'd say copyright that sucker and put it out. and help us burn this thing down, start to create the conflict that needs to happen so that there can be a resolution to how we're going to treat this concept. Because either we're going to take intellectual property concept and say, okay, you don't own what you think and what you create, and what you, which is going to, it's impossible to go from where we are to there. Or we're going to have to determine whether the ownership of those works created completely violate the data they're scouring to create it. So that's going to be a fascinating argument, and it'll have a retroactive impact on all kinds of work that people are creating right now.
Yeah, and it's interesting to watch the Beatles not take advantage of it, but to say, okay, we can use this for something positive. But I just did an article on this for my employment at Arizona State University for ASU News on the movie industry. And of course, the people striking are wondering what's going to happen with AI and screenwriting and acting. And so the attorney that I spoke to basically said, if there's contract language, you're going to be protected. I think that's the key to almost everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. But and in fact, you know, as a writer, the copywriters of the world are the first ones initially replaced with ChatGPT. Not that that's our topic, but it seems to be where we're starting. And I never thought about it as a documentarian or as a novelist. Do you see any impact, or are you? Tell me what you see as the impact from that point of view, from writers.
Well, again, the gentleman that I spoke to said that screenwriters are more in danger than actors because you can't replace personality or screen presence. And when I was at work one day, a younger gentleman brought up the idea of ChatGPT, and I was telling him, hey, I'm having a hard time writing this lead for this story. He goes, hey, let me try ChatGPT. He put it in there, and man, it was like this beautiful lead for the story. Yeah. And I went, no, I'm not going to go down that road.
You know, and then it's funny. It's like, do I spend the money as a producer, as a studio, do I spend the money to hire this noted writer who's going to want a lot of money to write this screenplay? Or do I ask ChatGPT to write something on the storyline and the style of everything he's done, and I get that one for free? And now I pay an editor to correct little things. Obviously, from a financial point of view, one's far wiser to no investment versus a substantial investment. But who owns the new one? Who owns that is my question. And when they file a copyright on it, do they own it? Because it took all of its idea from scouring other data. So it's just fascinating to me where that's going. Yeah. But back to your work with the 30 titles, we mentioned, you have a music interest and you've written about the music business. You've written about a bit about Elvis with a few books. But before we jump into music, let's go back to your work on Steve McQueen, because you are considered by many to be the foremost historian author on Steve McQueen, with 7 different published books on him. So I have 2 particular questions for you that I'd like you to address. And one is, what differentiates one book from the other? And second, I'd love for you to explain the beginnings of your fascination with this particular movie star.
Okay. I'll take the last one first, and then I'll go into the other books. So my fascination came from my father, who was the original Steve McQueen fan. So McQueen, he'd be 83 years old now, had he lived. Wait, is it 83 or 93?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
He was born in 1930. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 93.
Yeah, he'd be 93. So, I mean, he's obviously a generation before me, but he was at the second end of his career. And of course, anytime that there was a McQueen movie out, my dad would take me out of school. We'd go watch it together.
Oh,
so
cool.
It was a bonding experience. And later on, when I traveled around the world and collected stories about McQueen, I find that other countries, people in the countries did the same thing. So I wasn't alone in that aspect. So what's fascinating about McQueen is that he appears to be the all-American hero, the guy like John Wayne, but behind the scenes, he was a very, very insecure man. And so what I discovered was that he did all these daredevil things. He portrayed himself in one way because he felt inadequate inside. So I love that dichotomy. And I think as a writer, those are the types of people that you're looking for. Like, you know, I always talk about John Lennon, same thing. I mean, I know that you do tribute shows to him, and John Lennon would sing about, you know, peace and love, but sometimes, you know, he was a very violent man. So there's that dichotomy.
John had this, you just need to love each other, you stupid morons. You know? It was definitely a dichotomy. So, well, it does make for fascinating characters.
Oh, absolutely. And anytime you find somebody like that, you just, you know, the book almost writes itself. So how the books are different. So the first book that I did on him was in 1993, and I was a rookie writer, and I felt like it showed. And then,
was it more of just an overview biography?
Yeah, it was still detailed, and I was lucky in that I was able to interview a lot of people before they passed on. So those were the last interviews that they gave. But again, I hadn't developed my writing style yet. So I rewrote it again in 2010, but then the advent of the internet came about, and I was able to do research and connect to people much faster. I was able to get a hold of documents, stuff that were in libraries, whereas previously you'd have to travel to that place. Now you can access them online. And I was just able to get so much more information. And I had become an author first and then a journalist second. So I had 20 years training as a journalist before I took stab at that second book called Steve McQueen, Life and Legend of an American Icon, much better than the first book. And then the other subsequent books were just little pieces of his life. So, for example, I did a book with a gentleman who was the prop master for the movie Le Mans. I did a book with his last wife called Steve McQueen, The Last Mile. Then I did a book called The Tribute to the King of Cool, where I interviewed people and they told their stories about Steve McQueen. So it was kind of a inward looking biography of him. And then the last one I did was called Steve McQueen in His Own Words, where it's just his quotes with a lot of photos. But the quotes were set up chronologically, photos were chronologically, and I always felt that McQueen had never really told his story before, so this was a way for him to tell his story, with me guiding it along the way.
And so it sounds like often you find it fascinating to work with a co-writer. I mean, when you find these people who have their perspective or their unique, you know, piece of the story, to bring them in all the way as co-writer and really work with them a lot.
Right.
Yeah, you have to give each another voice.
You have to really trust somebody to do that. I did that with the Pete Maravich book because
Pete Maravich was, I loved Pete when I was a kid, famous basketball player.
Yeah.
First guy who had long, shaggy, blonde hair, I think, playing basketball.
That's right, and the droopy socks. Yeah. And he was a white Harlem Globetrotter who played in a very fundamentalistic basketball league. Mm-hmm. So he was he was the Pied Piper of basketball.
Yeah.
And he died at the age of 40 of a heart attack.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I was exchanging emails with this guy who had all these tapes on Maravich, and I would send him chapters and he'd write stuff and give it great context and statistics. Finally, it was one of those John Lennon, Paul McCartney moments where you go, okay, I could do this alone, but I'd be stronger if I had him.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to partner up. And so oftentimes I did that with the J.C. Ring book that I'm working on now. I'm working with a gentleman.
Which book?
It's on J.C. Ring, the hairstylist.
Oh, this.
And
right.
I'm doing it with his nephew. So he's got his family archive and all these great photos. And he's got a lot more insight into J.C. Ring than I do. I'm writing the story. I'm sending it to him. He'll have his little thing. And then as we went along, I'd say, okay, I think I want you to write some chapters now. Because this is a big, heavy-duty, 400-page book. And so we're getting close, but as we head towards the last of it, each chapter is getting more painful to write. Because there's so much more complexity to it. Before, it was Jay's story. Now then you get into the Manson family, and then you get into the murderers, and then the media and how they treated that, and then the victim advocacy thing. So it's getting really, really complex and hard to write. But I'm glad I have him because it's nice to have a partner, because when it's such a isolating job and it's such a you're alone that you need that someone to keep pulling you through.
Yeah. And I would think that having somebody who's personally related to the story, family, for example, they also bring, almost like the color commentator in the sports game, they give you just a whole nother point of view, the human point of view, where you're getting stats and statistics and facts to tell the story, but they kind of give you the color of the moment.
Absolutely. Know? Yeah. And great, great insight in what the family's going through. You know, often in these murder cases, I mean, especially with Manson, all the focus went to Manson and the family. Almost everybody forgot about the victims. And that's the real shame of that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, when you are writing a book, typically, what's the longest time you've spent working on one?
The Maravich book, now again, this is pre-internet. The Maravich book took 7 years.
Okay.
And the reason why is we interviewed 300 people, and I manually transcribed all those tapes, and it took me 2 years just to transcribe the tapes.
That's a lot of spare time, Marshall.
No, because I was holding jobs all this time. So I was a reporter the whole time. No, so it's a matter of just discipline and doing it every night and every day.
That's a lot of off work time. So let me ask you this. Did you have the opportunity to use now your work as a reporter where you could actually be doing a story and get more information for your texts or your books? Was there any cross-pollination there that worked out for you?
Absolutely. It always helps because you're always, as a reporter, you're always collecting information and storing information. And you're always looking for ways to get information. So that's very, very helpful, especially when you're looking for government information or a military file. In the case of Steve McQueen, nobody knew who his real father was. So in 2009, there was a census. The new census rolls came out, and it finally listed his father, and it gave a Social Security number. And from that Social Security number, I was able to locate his military file. From his military file, I was able to get his picture, and his list, he listed some dependents. And so he had listed Steve McQueen had a sister that he didn't know about, and she was still alive at the time that I contacted her. So knowing how to do that through my job as a reporter was helpful to me in my job as an author.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Did you go to journalism school and then get a gig as a reporter, and where, or how did that come about in your life?
I got hired by Thompson Newspapers, and at the time they ran East Valley Tribune.
So you grew up in the Valley then?
Well, I've been here since 1982. My dad is from the Globe, Miami area. So I'm a military brat, so we were from everywhere. Mm-hmm. So when I did that first Steve McQueen book, I went to the Library of Congress to do all my study on McQueen. And then of course, as a journalist, you learn different ways of accumulating information and how to get it. And so I was sent to a journalism school for an accelerated one for 4 months. So I went to Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
I love the place.
Yeah. It was fun. I loved Wisconsin. It was great. And
I did a bunch of records in Wisconsin.
And so I was able to go to journalism school. And then, of course, the real education is when you get on the job. So I was on the job for 10 years. So to me, that was really my education.
Okay. And so you got out of journalism as a profession. Is that when you went into working at ASU?
That's correct. Okay. What had happened was is that I always say I literally saw the writing on the wall. This was at the transition where, you know, the paper was starting to go internet. 2008.
Okay.
So newspaper was doing great before, because I was one of the few journalists that cared about the money that the paper brought in, and they had this whiteboard in the back of this room, and it was in a different separate area, and I'd go in that back room with the salespeople, and I'd look at the numbers, and I'd see how well we were doing, and then
virtually seeing the writing on the wall.
and then by 2008, I'm seeing these numbers go down, and to a point where it was pathetic, and it just told me, okay, I got to get into something else.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, what would I transition into? It's like, okay, I've done some PR for my books on my own. I'd love to work for ASU. So I was initially the downtown Phoenix liaison, and I wrote lots of press releases, and I touted the campus, and it was a great time because that's when the campus first came on, and they were erecting buildings, you know, right and left, and so I was getting a lot of publicity for the school, and it worked out great. And then there was a new person that came in, and he turned things around and changed it into more of a news format. So then I became a reporter again. So, you know, we talked about transitions earlier. So mm-hmm. those are the types of transitions I've had to make.
Yeah. Have you liked working at ASU?
I love it. I love it because I've been an author where I've been in my house all alone all day. I don't like that.
Yeah.
So I have a great job at ASU where I show up, I do my work, and then it kind of mentally sets me up for writing, because writing the books is kind of like my treat. And so I get done with this stuff, and then I have my books at night, and then I work on the weekends.
Yeah, and if it was just the books, that would be work. You need to get away from the house to get the break, kind of.
Absolutely.
Tell me about the space at home where you write, then. Is there one room, typically, or you sit at a computer? Or is it, do you have different chairs you want to move into? You write on a pad of paper? What do you do?
Well, no, I have an office, and I tell the wife, okay, I'm going into my office and I'm shutting the door and I won't be back out for a few hours. So if you want to go see a movie.
It's
if
like the Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe. I'm going to go in here. I'm going to come out later. I don't know how it's going to be. Or if I'm going to be 20 years older or 20 minutes older.
Yeah, and my wife is extremely understanding. She knows that that's what I do.
Yeah.
But lately, at night, I'm a night owl, so we'll watch TV together, but I'll have my little laptop. Right. I have a little tray, and I have my laptop. So the last book I wrote on the serial killer, I pretty much wrote in bed at night, mm-hmm. from, say, 9 at night till like 12, and I could do a chapter a night. Yeah. So it was... So you adapt and you find different ways, but I find that going into an office and shutting the door is the best way.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the writing at night when your wife's watching TV. My wife has a job where she's on the computer all day long studying numbers, right, and doing data. And so she equates the computer to a horrible thing. So she doesn't want to look at a screen after work. I spend all day working on music and video on a computer. It's almost like playing a game, creating stuff. I think the computer is a wonderful place to be. And as soon as I'm off work, all I want to do is look at my computer screen the rest of the day. So she doesn't understand how I can just keep wanting to be on the computer. She needs to change her brain set and quit thinking and receive something innocuous. So she likes to watch TV. I have no interest in watching TV. If I'm home alone, I just don't get off my computer. So now with our home, we have the kitchen and the living room space are kind of the same space. It's big. So I can, just like you said, I sit there now with my laptop working on something while we're both on the couch watching TV. Or I scooch over to the island in the kitchen where I'm not far away and I can kind of watch what kind of work. My mind has to keep going all the time. My mind never needs to shut down and take a break. So I'm always trying to create.
Well, the cool thing about that is that to me, that's the great litmus test for like a show. You know, if a show captivates you, you put down the computer and you start watching.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't captivate you, you just keep on working.
Yeah. And speaking of shows, we just finished a show. Have you seen Bloodline? It's a Netflix series.
Is that the one in Florida?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we just started watching it. And we raced through it. I think it was 3 seasons, like 30 some odd episodes. You could tell season 3 was a different DP and I hated it. But the stories got so good that I immediately didn't care because it got better. But in the last 2 episodes were so bad.
Yeah.
When they finished the story, I was like, really? I went through all this and you're just going to throw it away like that?
Yeah, I felt that so last season, it jumped the shark for sure.
Yeah, I think sometimes that's because they think there might be a 4th season and they're told right at the last minute, we're not renewing, wrap it up. You're like, how? We love it. It always open ends, you know. So that was kind of difficult. But as a writer, I can imagine that is a difficult process. And have you done any screenplay writing at all?
No, and you know, that's the one thing that I always say that's out of my purview. It's a different art form.
It is a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've learned that because I've tried to write one. And then, you know, you give it to somebody in the industry and after they read the first page and you ask them, how did you like it? They go, I couldn't get past the first page. Like, what do you mean? Like, you don't know how to write a screenplay. Yeah. There's so many rules about where information goes and what you do and don't say. So it is a whole different process. When it gets to your books, what was the first book you did or the first success you found in writing as an author that made you feel like, oh, this, I can do this, can work. Was it the very first McQueen book?
It was the very first McQueen book. And so it was not only, it was sold 50,000 copies. I mean, that was a bestseller.
Who's the publisher on that first book?
That was Donald I. Fine. And they were an independent publisher out of New York, but they were still considered a big...
How did you land them on your first book?
Here's what I did. And I always tell first-time writers this. So I decided that because I was an unknown, I was going to write my first book and finish it, have it fully edited, and find a publisher who would like it. So that's what I did. I spent 3.5 years writing it, and you'll love this. I supported myself. I lived in D.C. at the time, but I supported myself by selling bootleg tapes and records. And I actually did quite well for myself. So it enabled me to, and this is before everything started cracking down, because I knew it was only going to be for a limited time. So I was able to pay off my student loan. I was able to support myself, and because it costs money to write a book, because you have to travel back and forth.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I finished the book, fully edited, and when you have something like that and you hand it to a publisher, it's hard for them to say no. And the reason why I chose Donald I. Fime was because they just published a book on the director, Sam Peckinpah. Peckinpah had directed two Steve McQueen movies, same genre, same everything. So I thought, okay, if they published a book on Peckinpah and McQueen is 100 times more popular, they're definitely going to do this. So the very first publisher I went to, very first agent I went to, and then that year, it was 1993. It was kind of like Steve McQueen had kind of come full circle again, because I think the way I look at pop culture is every 20 years, things come around. Remember in the 70s, Happy Days was the big thing, yeah, and everything that was 50s, American Graffiti.
Right.
It's because the people that went to high school are now grown adults and they're looking back.
Yeah.
Same thing with McQueen, you know, big figure of the 60s and 70s. And now these people that loved them were now adults, had the disposable income to buy a book. So that's the way my mind works. I'm always thinking commercially, not artistically, although the product has to be artistic too.
Right, right. Have you done any self-publishing, or is it always
published? I have done one self-published book, and that was on a book I knew that no one was going to publish, but I had to write it for myself. Mm-hmm. I always called it my Nebraska, you know,
okay.
with Bruce Springsteen's right. album. Right. And this was, and the reason why I had to do this, I did a 3-part series on Zora Foley, and nobody could ever explain how he died. He died mysteriously. And so this was something that was in my backyard and I couldn't figure out. And I, you know, with a newspaper article, I just didn't have time to figure it out. It took me 10 years to finally figure out where that autopsy report was and where his police report was. So I'd been told at the time that I did the article that it didn't exist, that they expunged their records after 7 years. And then again, it just never went away. And so finally I started talking to an Arizona State librarian, and I talked to him about how frustrated I was and talked about police reports. He says, well, you know, we here at the library, we keep all those old police reports on microfiche. And I said, you're kidding me. I said, do you have 1972 for Tucson? He said, I sure do. Well, I spent 3 days at the library and I finally found the police report and it gave me everything I needed. And I finally solved it and I cracked the case. Now, but again, he was kind of an obscure figure. He fought Muhammad Ali, but only people, old school boxers, know who he is. So I self-published it, and I did an audiobook for it. And so it was just one of those things where I had to satisfy myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just mentioned audiobooks. So you just did something very interesting, cutting edge, with McCartney Media out in L.A., where you recorded your voice for their Living Vault, or whatever they're calling this. Tell me about this process and what's happening.
Well, because I was told that I'm always reading up on industry stuff. So I think I read an article where 47% of all books are now being consumed through audiobooks. And audiobook people that listen to audiobooks, they want to hear the author. So it's kind of like resonated with me, like, because I've always kind of wanted to be the author. That I don't want my picture on the book. I don't want anybody to know who I am. I just want to be the guy that presents the story and let the story be the star. But that can't happen in this day and age. Everybody has to be a star. So I decided that it was time to record a book, and I did it for Zora Foley, and I did it because it was a smaller book, and it wasn't going to take me a whole lot of time to do it. So you know, I recorded it. It was wonderful. It didn't take that long. And so they've packaged it and it just came online, I want to say yesterday. And the whole process took only about a month.
So what's cool is now you didn't have to read the whole book for the audio tape. Their process used your voice and created your audio book.
Right.
That's pretty awesome. Especially for an author with 30 books.
Yes. And eventually, I want to do all of the books myself, but I don't really feel like I've got a great voice for books. So, but it was great in that it was able to get all my tone and inflection, and I did play it for one of my publishers, and he's a British fellow, and he said, "Is it my imagination or is your voice a bit monotone. So I won't be able to make a living off of it, but it was still a fun process. It was cool. It was exciting. And, you know, that'll be the first of many that I do.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, in the digital process of creating a separate text from voice samples of an author's voice, I bet they'll start to employ random pitch shifting too to elevate and, you know, create another version of the expression. But it's going to be fascinating to see where they take that. Let's dive into some of your music stuff. You, or actually before we do that, let me just, we're on Steve McQueen. Let's just cross over to film. You produced or executive produced a documentary that grossed well over $1.5 million at movie theaters on Steve McQueen, American Icon. It was called. So tell me about your involvement and process of that.
Well, that I got a call from the evangelist Greg Laurie, and he wanted to do a story on Steve McQueen and how he became a Christian at the end of his life. And so that was an interesting take because it's a story that hasn't been told that often. So he wanted to do a book and a documentary. So he asked me to do the book, and the bonus was, hey, do you want to be an executive producer on this thing? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. I'd always wanted to get into it. And so that was actually, I find that more thrilling than writing books because, I don't know, there's something about the movie industry that is very exciting.
Can't argue with you there.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know what it is. It's just...
It's fascinating that the whole all of those aspects of production from writing to then shooting to then editing and post production. I obviously with what I do, I'm fascinated with it all. So yeah. Tell me about your involvement then. Were you?
So what I did was I set up the interviews. I found the locations, and that wasn't easy because in California, specifically Los Angeles, they want to charge you for locations. They want to charge you like a $10,000 fee. So I had to be very, very creative in where I found locations. And some of them were in hotel rooms. The hotel rooms would legally let you set up and shoot inside the room, but I wanted to shoot out on a patio, and they're like, well, no, that's going to cost you $20,000. So I rented a really cool room, got two people. We shot on one angle one way, one the other. We shot someone on a rooftop in downtown LA. So that was fun. And then I provided, I knew which were royalty free pictures. I provided some recordings. I had a recording of Steve McQueen on his deathbed that they played, which was kind of like the centerpiece of the story, which he talked about his faith. So it's one thing to write about it and say, yeah, he did this. But when you hear it on tape, it's irrefutable.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to another pairing with Greg Laurie on Johnny Cash book.
Yeah. I wanted to get on that one.
And I'd never,
the redemption of an American icon.
Yeah, and I never really wasn't much of a Johnny Cash fan at all. But I'm always open to writing about people and finding what's fascinating about them. And again, this was serendipitous because there's a gentleman that you might know by the name of Reggie Vinson.
I know Reggie very
okay.
well.
Rockin' Reggie. Yeah. So Reggie wanted to write a book, and he was put in touch with me through Jeff Moore of Alice Cooper Solid Rock Foundation. And so we met, and he didn't know anything about my connection to the Johnny Cash thing. I had to find a way to get into the Johnny Cash estate. And so I go to his house, I meet him. There's a picture of Rockin' Reggie with Johnny Cash. And I look at it and I go, Reggie, what are you doing with Johnny Cash? He said, well, you know, I met him and I went on one of his crusades, and his sister Joanne is one of my best friends. I said, I thought for a second. I said, okay, here's the deal. Reggie, I will help edit this book for you. I will help write it. You make an introduction to Joanne Cash and we have a deal. So he shook my hand and that was it.
Yeah. You know, and that's the way Reggie's whole life has been. He always runs into just the person he needs to do just the thing he wants to do. And he's always said, I'm just so blessed. And he's a fascinating and fun character. I've worked on a couple records with him.
Yeah.
Very, very fun. So so that was your introduction to Johnny Cash then, essentially.
Yes.
Just studying for that project.
Yeah. And learning about him. I mean, a really fascinating guy. One of those pivotal characters, and I don't even know if you can call him a country artist. He really didn't.
He's bigger than that.
Yeah, he blurred these lines
of
rockabilly.
What's a lot of fun, if you go on YouTube and look for a television episode of Johnny Cash imitating Elvis Presley, It is one of the funniest things you've ever seen, because he's doing it when they were both young and they were both just coming up. And it's very hilarious. So yep. you get a kick out of that.
Yep.
And speaking of Elvis, we got to get on. I want to make sure we cover Elvis and mention your production company and touch on Lennon, Dylan, Alice, and Jesus before we wrap up. So let's get to Elvis. Right. You've written three books on Elvis Presley.
Right.
And a documentary as well, I believe.
Let me think. Documentary. That's not coming
actually,
to me.
Actually, yeah, it was called, I take it back, my notes are the three books on Elvis Presley and a companion book for Jesus Music, which
that's right.
turned into a documentary about the history of contemporary Christian music.
That's right. There we go. So the three Elvis books were, I did a book with his army buddy, and it was called Sergeant Presley. And I didn't want to do a big Elvis book. I just wanted to focus on one little aspect of his life. So his army buddy and his wife knew Elvis in Germany, and so they gave insight into his life there. Second book was bigger. Then I met Sonny West, who was Elvis's bodyguard.
Right.
I'd read that book, Elvis, What Happened in High School, and was fascinated with it. And so that book, it first exposed Elvis's drug issue. And so the three guys that wrote it, they were sort of banished for a long time in the Elvis world. And so I thought, well, it'd be interesting to do a book about him being banished, what that was like, what's the aftermath, does he feel sorry that he did it? And so that book, I think, came out, I want to say in 2006, 2007. And then from there, I thought, well, I'll never do another Elvis book, because it's nerve-wracking, because you have to get it right, because all those, it's not to say that I don't get my other books right, but everybody's watching when you do an Elvis book, and you've got Elvis historians that know right. every little thing and every little fact, and you just have to get it right. So the next book, so I was approached by Greg McDonald. Greg was Colonel Parker's protege. And so he basically wanted to do a book on the Elvis Colonel Parker relationship. And what he basically told me was Colonel Parker was not a bad guy. He had this attitude of the artist always wears the white hat. And if he is besmirched in any way, I'll take the hit for him. And Colonel Parker didn't mind wearing the black hat, because it also enhanced his status, because he was constantly doing battle with guys that had degrees and diplomas, and he was a carny. And all he had were his street smarts. So if he didn't mind being the bad guy. But what Greg told me was that, you know, in real life, Colonel Parker was a pretty good guy, had a very charitable heart, was very thankful for everything that he got. He came to this country penniless, made something of himself. And then, he broke down the money situation, which everybody always harps on. Well, he took 50% of Elvis's income. Well, that's not true. There were really four pots of money, and that was recording, movies, merchandise, and touring. The first three that I mentioned, he took 25%. The last one, touring, he took 50%, but it was a joint venture partnership. And everything came off the top of Elvis's expenses. So after all those expenses were deducted, they split that 50%. The other reason for the 50% was because the colonel employed people under him, because the concert tours took more people. So I didn't find that unreasonable. And then right. on top of that, you know, he served as his manager, his publicist, his lawyer, his promoter. So he had four or five different functions.
Yeah. Yeah. The recent movie Elvis, where Tom Hanks is playing Colonel Parker. I enjoyed the film. It was funny. My 18-year-old daughter said afterwards, she goes, the whole thing felt like a movie trailer to me. And I didn't ever think about that I didn't get that impression until I heard her comment. But the whole thing, every moment was so glossy and so presented as the moment that it was very kind of surreal. And I had anticipated to feel a little bit more like a real storytelling. But they certainly played, Colonel Parker as the bad guy.
Right. Yeah. And
as I understand from the little preview snippet I've seen of your book, he had an opportunity to speak with the family to get a different perspective before they did the film.
Right. And so it's interesting that Priscilla defends Colonel Parker.
Yeah.
And she defended him to the press, even while the movie, because Tom Hanks had dinner with her one night, and he told the press, told Variety magazine specifically, I thought he was a scoundrel, and I went into this meeting, and then Priscilla talked to me and said, no, he's a wonderful man, and I'm glad that he was in our corner.
Yeah.
So, you know, perspective is everything.
It is, and I learned a lot, like I said, from the little snippet I read, which we won't talk about. I won't talk about it any further, but the relationship beyond that with the estate in Cornwall Park, it says a lot, you know. So that was fascinating. So let's talk about some of the other music, too, besides the Elvis books. Let's see, you do have the Lennon, Dylan, Alice, and Jesus text. Let's hear about that one.
That one was written with Greg Laurie, who wanted to... We had written a series of historical biographies with a Christian bend. And so the trilogy was Steve McQueen, Johnny Cash, and Billy Graham, Greg's three heroes. And then he wanted to do a book on rock stars and Christianity. And I'd actually done a book like that in 2016 with Ken Mansfield, who was a producer. I'm sorry. Yeah, he's a producer, but he was the manager for Apple Records under the Beatles. And so Ken had talked to me about the link between Christianity and music and rock stars. I said, I don't see it. And he said, well, music is spiritual. And so he said, it's no secret to me why these people change at the end of their lives. I mean, they're no longer a rock star. It's no longer appealing. It kind of wears off after a while, and then you start looking for a deeper meaning in life. So I had done that book with him, and I chronicled 10 rock stars. So with Greg, it was a similar concept, but he wanted to take on the icons, and it didn't matter what their beliefs were. He just wanted to chronicle what their beliefs ultimately were, if they were good, bad, indifferent, or what have you. So that's what that book is about. So Bob Dylan, for example, as you know, went through a Christian phase in the late 70s. I remember reading in Rolling Stone, just every week he was getting some sort of grief. John Lennon we call a spiritual tourist because he tried a little bit of everything. And he even dabbled in Christianity. And then, of course, there's Alice Cooper, who we devoted a whole chapter to, who is definitely the real deal. And I'm sure you've had dealings with him. I've had dealings with him. I know his son Dash, and they definitely are the real deal. And Solid Rock Foundation is just proof of that.
Oh yeah, incredible. And I think it's fascinating because you look at Alice Cooper, the character from the early years, you know, but he grew up with a preacher father. So it's not far from the church right from the beginning, but you'd never think, oh, that guy, he's a Christian. The snake handling, biting, you know, it's almost like fire breathing, whatever. I mean, so his show has always been this horror show, you know. So it's kind of funny to me. That's kind of
yeah. But you know, the other interesting aside is my sister and brother-in-law have gone to church with them for years. So I mean, I knew about this, you know, forever. And He was in church every week, and I specifically remember in the '93 Suns when they went to they were playing the Bulls in the finals.
I saw that.
And
game.
That very last game.
I saw
that very last game was a Sunday, and it was I saw Colangelo, I saw Paul Westfall, I saw Alice Cooper in there, and I don't know why at the time I was mad. I was like, why are Colangelo and Westfall and Church, man, they need to be out at the arena.
Yeah, that was
but
funny.
That shows.
Well, you got to bring up the Suns. That was a heartbreak year, and they've never gotten closer. That was like, and what's funny is I really thought they were going to win. I was in Mississippi at the time for the during that weekend or a week, and made a deal with family members. It was a big family reunion on in-laws' side. Said if the Suns lost, because they were Chicago fans. I said if the Suns lost, I'll jump in the pool. I won't even empty my pockets. Well, I jumped in the pool and I didn't empty my pockets.
Did you have an iPhone in there?
Luckily, no. Back in '93, I did not. So I did have a phone, so it's just kind of comical. But getting back to that book, real quick, the Lennon, Dylan, Alice, and Jesus book. Well, then on the Jesus flip side, did you study as a person Jesus, and did you take the rock star side of his lifestyle? I mean, the fact that what it was like for him and his life to have the attention he had.
We actually did not discuss really Jesus. We just
so
talked
he's
about
more like the impact, the religion aspect, and on other people, aspect of these lives. Okay.
Yeah.
I wondered. It's a cool book cover. I like the book cover.
That was Greg Laurie's concept, because they were going to have a picture of just like a record on a vinyl groove, and he's like, no, that's not my concept at all. And Greg used to be a graphic artist, so he knows exactly what he wants, and his ideas are fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your production company. In 2022, you launched True Tales of the Southwest. And what's the purpose and scope, and what's been going on?
Well, the purpose of that was I got such a high from executive producing those films. I was like, man, this is what I want to do, in addition to writing books. And it's called True Tales of the Southwest because we just want to focus on Southwestern stories. Because if you do any traveling with your camera equipment, you know, it means hotel rooms, it means meals. We wanted to focus on, because as a journalist, I know all these great stories that are happening in Arizona, New Mexico. We're doing a story about a serial killer from Tucson. And that was a big story in the 60s. Life magazine covered it, Time, Newsweek. So all these people that were teens are now in their 70s and 80s. And so no one's really done a full-length documentary. There were some books that came out when the murders occurred. But now we're 50 years down the road. And so as a result of this, we got a hold of the widow who talked. And I finished that book with her. So I'd never seen a book, a memoir from a serial killer's widow. So I thought, this would be interesting to get that insight.
And does your journalism background help you with these true crime type stories? Because you know how to dig for that detail.
Oh, absolutely. And I've got a subscription to newspapers.com, which is just phenomenal because it gives you the pulse at the time. And so
newspapers.com.
Yeah.
So you can pull it, type in a date and time and place or whatever, and see the papers.
Yes, if they have a subscription to it. So and great pictures too. So it's been a great tool. It's been a great resource, and also it's a great way. Like if you dig that up and you present that to the person, say, "Do you remember this? Here's what this article says," and then it stirs up those memories.
Well, what are some Arizona or Southwest stories that besides this one that you kind of think off the top of your head you might like to write about?
Well, we want to do a documentary on Tombstone, but we want to do it with an interesting twist, kind of a Westworld twist. There are people that go to Tucson and their idea of retirement is to go to Tombstone and dress up like somebody in the 1800s and walk the streets. And their whole life is revolved around that. They don't have electricity in their house. And they go to the saloon hall for their entertainment. And so we want to focus on some of those people. So we want to take it from a serial killer to more of a lighthearted thing. I remember reading about a interesting cult in the Arizona-California border. They're now all in their 70s and 80s. So to me, it'll be interesting to find out, okay, you started this in the 60s. Now you're in your 80s. You're close to death. What are your beliefs now? How has this held up? So to me, there's all sorts of fascinating stories out there just about Arizona.
You know, there's a lot of sports stories, certainly, and a lot of people. So there's a lot of stories there. Also, I think racing. There could be some racing stories with all the racing that happens in Arizona. You know, as far as music goes, you might be uniquely positioned to focus on some Arizona music history too.
Yeah,
because there's a lot. There's a lot there.
I'll tell you a funny story real quick about Arizona music and history. Dave Pratt, who I never knew but I listened to, texted me out of the blue. He didn't text me. He thought it was somebody else.
Okay,
and I get this text, and I look at it, and I text him back. I said, "Dave, I don't think this is intended for the person that you wanted to go to." I said, "But I not only read your book, but I know the person who did your book, who produced your book." And then I start giving him some memories, and so he calls me. He goes, "You mean to tell me, out of all the people that I text, I get somebody who's read my book and knows the person who produced it and knows all this history about me?" Because I signed it off with, like, Elko, Nevada, because that's where he's from.
Right, of course.
And so he called me, and we had this great conversation for like an hour.
Yeah.
Talking about the radio industry, and Again, what we've talked about, how the industry's changed. And then I sent him a nice book. I sent him the Lennon, Dylan, Alice, Jesus book. Yeah. And then he sent me a nice postcard back. So
that's cool. Well, now, you know, we webcast out of his studios, you know, at Camelback Road. So that's kind of cool. Full circle there. And I met Dave. Gosh, I can't remember when I first met him, but first time we actually had this, got a chance to sit down and have some fun was right after American Idol came out, because they were doing the second season. They started the regional preliminaries, like Fox had the Arizona Idol here. So if you won their contest, you got to like bypass some of the processes to get to the national. They did that in all the major markets for 2 or 3 years. So the first year, they needed some judges, you know. And so that's how I met Ruth McCartney. We were both judges 1 year. And I think it was the next year they decided they wanted Dave Pratt and I to come on the morning show every day after American Idol and say what we thought. Because at that point, it was two nights in a row. You know, they do the contest and then they have the winner or whatever. And I'd never watched the show. I had no interest in it. So then I had to watch it that season just to go on in the mornings. They would come to my studio in Central Phoenix with film crew, and Dave and I would sit there and we would just say what we thought about the show every morning, you know, every week while that was going on. So that was a lot of fun. And then, of course, you know, so many other cross paths. Whenever I was funny, I used Dave this way. Whenever my life was in the dumps, I called Dave, "Hey, man, what's going on? You know, I'm doing the streaming thing, but I go over there and check out the studio. You should do a show." And I said, "Why would I do that for? Cause, man, it'd be great. You just talk to people about your, you know, what they do in the business." And he really got me started just because I was closing a recording studio. I didn't have anything to do. And he talked me into starting the podcast 5 or 6, 7 years ago now, you know, nonstop. So he's a great guy to be involved with. He's very, very energetic, positive, and a lot of fun.
Let me ask you, though, real quickly about the Idol process. And they say that that's kind of replaced the club scene and where artists used to come up through the clubs and became recording artists that way. And again, being old school, I have a bias to where, oh, I think that's the best way.
Right.
Now that this has kind of become a staple, is that really the best way to come up, do you think?
No, I don't think. In fact, I see them as completely different. American Idol at one point, the first couple of years they were out, had the top 10 selling records on iTunes. You know, top 10 selling musical artists were game show contestants, is the way I looked at it. The thing about American Idol, they're not looking for an act that's talented. And when they find a singer that's good, they turn them into what they're trying to turn them into. So there's nothing about artistry involved. It's television on talented singers, and personalities are stories that are worth telling. I've seen incredible singers get turned down because they go, you know what we're looking for. We don't need good singers right now. We got plenty of good singers. You know, we need better TV than that. I think other shows or other opportunities that allow artists to be represented is where that still exists.
Which is your show, actually.
We introduced 80 independent artists, so you'd never find anyplace else to, if you like them, go find them, you know. But I think then we're not turning them into something. We're merely dusting them off, polishing them up a little bit and saying, here's a quick look, you know, and trying to introduce their personality and the purpose of their art and then let you go discover that. It's the neat thing, I think, about defining music these days, which for young kids is kind of cool, are these playlists like on Spotify. Because when you say, give me a playlist based on this artist, all of a sudden Billy Joel will show up in that list or somebody else that we never would have picked to put on there. And so then they go look at this person. And I'm walking down the hall in my house and I hear my daughter, who always blares her music when she's in the shower, and I hear Goodnight Vienna, you know, blaring. And I'm like, wow, there's hope, you know. And then they discover Led Zeppelin. I remember my older daughter coming to me, do you have any Led Zeppelin records, Dad? And you're like, holy cow, where are you discovering this, you know? So that's the neat thing about playlists today. It's really broadening their palette because radio gives them very narrow option to listen to music.
Well, what I love on YouTube is I watch these things where young people are playing the old school music and they're discovering
it for the first time.
So like they're listening to Boston More Than a Feeling and they're like, man. And I noticed specifically with black artists, they love riffs. They love rock and roll riffs and they glom onto it. And I can see where they use that, you know, in rap music and they love that. So it's just fun to watch young people discover things from the 60s and 70s and really good music.
Yeah, because we had great music. And great lyrics. I mean, Jim Croce came playing on the, you know, Alexa the other day or whatever. And it's like, oh my gosh, listen to these stories. Operator. I mean, you remember, wow, who, you had to think about it. You had to craft it. You had to express an emotion. There seemed to be so much more intention in storytelling than there seems to be today, at least in popular music.
Yeah.
Well, let me just ask you this as we're running out of time here. If people do want to reach out to you, what's the best way to find you?
Well, I'm pretty available on Facebook, and I have a website called marshallterrell.com, and I'm pretty accessible. I, as a reporter, I get 50 emails a day. I always pride myself on answering each one within a reasonable amount of time. So
you don't have a lot of fan mail to deal with yet.
No. Just, I don't know if I have a lot of fans, but I have a lot of people reach out to me.
Cool. Well, listen, man, I just want to thank you for coming in and talking about what you're doing and everything you've been doing. Appreciate your time.
And it's been wonderful having this interesting friendship where we just kind of bump into each other.
Yeah, I don't think it's over. In fact, when we're done here, I got some questions for you, so we'll keep it going. But thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
And you've been listening to The Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Networks, and we will see you again next week.